You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, I get to catch up with a longtime friend of ECSP, Kleena Raleigh. Kleena is a political geographer and professor at the University of Sussex and directs the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, or ACLED, which tracks local conflict events in 50 countries. Her research focuses mainly on conflict, governance, and the social consequences of climate change in sub-Saharan Africa. Kleena, thanks so much for joining us today. It's really good to see you. It's been a number of years since we've had an opportunity to catch up, and more than a decade since we've spoken to you on New Security Beat and through ECSP's channels. So thank you very much for connecting today. Why don't we just start with hearing sort of an update on your research and what the last decade plus has brought to you in terms of insights.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Lauren. It's a real pleasure, as always. So in the last 10 years or so, I run ACLED as well as do quite a lot of work on the political geography of states, often African states. And so ACLED has gone global, and I've been working really consistently on trying to understand some of the local and subnational politics of countries that are in and out of crisis. And one of the main conclusions that I think is relevant to a discussion about climate security, which I think we'll be having today, is that there's far more conflict than people usually think about. So we have discovered that about half the world's population live in an area of active or latent conflict. And that really got me thinking about the other crises that they live with somewhat simultaneously, and then what means or methods on the local level, including things like local administration, either tend to exacerbate those risks or mitigate them. And so quite a lot of my work has been around how different elites and their relationships between the local areas and the regime kind of shape and form conflict risk as a result of the competitive politics that happens within developing states. But it also really got me reflecting on the fact that there's, in terms of the climate change risk, which is of course like an ever-present, growing, persistent risk across the world, not just in the areas that I'm speaking about, but in particular, these areas that often have the highest risk, but sometimes some of the lowest ways to mitigate it, there's actually a huge amount of cooperation in communities around this risk. And really, conflict is often happening to these communities quite separate from their ongoing struggles with vulnerability to the environment.
Okay, so to sort of expand on that point, you're saying that there's sort of conflict dynamics that are not related to environmental degradation in the area or scarcity issues or competition over natural resources. Do you find places where there are connections between conflict dynamics, whether or not they're direct, right? But maybe they're sort of adding stress to relationships or driving an increase in conflict, but not necessarily sparking it. Do you see that kind of connection?
That's a really good question. So let me clarify by saying conflict is a competition for power, right? It's not because of grievance. It's not because of resource distribution. It's not because of population dynamics. And so where we have contests in which some attribute of the environment, often through financing, for example, through patronage and through other means of financing, come into a competitive interpretation of how elites are going to operate and contest each other violently, that's the only case. But I mean, it's quite far removed from actually being at risk due to your vulnerability to climate change. There's several avenues in which that needs to travel down. And so I really think that when I go to places that may or may not be affected by intermittent or full-blown conflict, what we see is that most communities in most places, in response to almost all of the negative climate effects that they find, they're cooperating with each other. And in fact, they're cooperating with each other, not just in response to obviously climate crises, but other crises that they frequently are subject to.
Have you seen any cases where that non-climate related cooperation has helped to then provide inroads into broader cooperation over something that might be climate related?
So, I mean, I think that there's an awful lot of attention, finally, I think this is brilliant, to local adaptation means, right? And I was mentioning earlier that my husband works on adaptation and we'll often be working in the same country and often in the same place. And he'll be going to an adaptation meeting, you know, where people are trying to get together, often including several layers of government about how they're going to implement an adaptation plan. And I'll be saying, well, there's some conflict risk in some of these places. We'll be working in the same place, we'll be working on the same thing, or thinking we're working on the same thing, but seeing totally different, and in fact, in many ways, opposing outcomes as a result. And it really got me thinking about whether or not the areas that have been able to build adaptation, like kind of adaptive cooperation, manage to become resilient to conflict or to breakdowns in that social and political order, to resist that kind of violent competition when it stems from other sources. And I think that that's certainly true in the sense that we have situations in Kenya where there were peace committees throughout the country that allowed people to discuss and to mediate in situations, especially, you know, related to resource distribution. And those mediations, especially when they were funded, were very successful. We have a situation, I think, in the middle belt of Nigeria, where more, even I would say, informal, but certainly kind of local based cooperative mechanisms started to fail. And then you got a rush of conflict that had taken the form of some of the more livelihood based competitions that we had previously seen. They weren't climate related. They were about a breakdown in these institutions.
Well, so then how do we take, you know, the climate security discussion has gained a lot of momentum in the last 10 years. And I think, you know, from our perspective, it's been a useful framing in some ways where you're able to get into the nuance of what it means and not make assumptions from the outset. And use it to shift how people think about what kinds of investments and policies and programs can be effective in both mitigating, you know, the impacts of climate on the ground, but also building a broader peace and mm-hmm. and helping people sort of understand this broader sense of what is security and the importance of integrating a human security lens into how we think about development and security more broadly. So, from your perspective, what can you touch on some of the limitations that you see in the climate security framing, and what you would like to see moving forward in terms of how it's being applied, and perhaps emphasizing that cooperation as a response, and having a climate security lens that has a more focused recognition of the resilience capacity on the ground and the need to be incorporating that into our sort of climate security thinking?
Yeah, I suppose that those are great questions. I will first say that—
it was like three questions. I didn't mean to do that.
Okay, I will first say that I suppose I am concerned about a security framing for a non-security problem, because as kind of sophisticated as our language around security has become outside of the situations that where we're actually talking about security outcomes, I feel like it loses this nuance that we bring to it when it's being practiced. And so I think that that's, you know, a lot of things have been securitized over the last 20 years, poverty, migration, the climate, and it has had identity, and it has had quite negative effects, I think, for the people who are supposed to be kind of on the receiving end of better policies or better assistance because of it. Because security usually means to people the opposite, insecurity. So And so that's where I feel like the lion's share of attention has been, is has been on finding insecurity or reframing current insecurity as climate related, instead of, as I mentioned, acknowledging that most people in most places experience some sort of climate change, whether mild to severe, but live in communities that are not insecure, that are not in conflict. And we seem to have kind of flipped that script a little. And rather than looking at the vast amount of climate cooperation we're looking for, we're searching desperately for some way to tie, even contentious, but typically cooperative community relationships as in some ways at risk. And Niels Peter-Gleditsch used a great phrase in 1998 about how an awful lot of the environmental security rhetoric at that point was using the future as evidence. And we now have 20 years of climate change evidence that we can look back on. And as a conflict researcher, I can tell you that its association with conflict is incredibly weak. And like I said, it's already in incredibly kind of difficult environments, politically complicated environments. And one of the things that I would suggest is that sometimes the securitization logic has replaced knowledge about the competition and the politics of these places. And I think that what this leads to is sometimes ill-judged solutions about who and what is vulnerable.
So the recent IPCC report, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it takes a sort of similar take on the climate security angle, because it says there's sort of limits the focus on a direct causal link between climate and conflict, but does recognize that it can have an impact on the length and severity and frequency of ongoing conflicts, and finds that they're sort of going back to your point about cooperation, that there is an opportunity to make investments now in development that could yield sort of a more peaceful and sustainable future in response to climate change if we take that lens. Is that sort of, would you agree with that?
I mean, I would love nothing more than if people found a solution to conflict, whether or not it's wrapped up in the climate or not. I would love it, you know? But I think the idea of kind of killing two birds with one stone has some utility, but We're not going to fix conflict without understanding the politics of why it's happening.
Sure.
And that's not been helped by replacing those politics with a kind of a very kind of homogenous environmental lens. But I will say this, which I mean, the IPCC report is excellent, as it always is. But I will say I was really kind of shocked that a number of civil society organizations, and I think kind of like development practitioner organizations, had an open letter to the IPCC saying, you're not taking climate security seriously. Mm-hmm. And it was because this has become like almost an unstoppable force. Mm-hmm. And it's returning to some of its most reductive conclusions, rather than the kind of nuanced, sophisticated conclusions that I'm sure that the IPCC generated from experts in the field. And that's what, it makes me worried now that we're returning to a time where all of this work and all of this interpretation of the importance of resilience, the importance of let's say different vulnerabilities, the importance of adaptation and what form it takes, and the importance of cooperation, I'm worried it might be lost.
That's interesting. Okay. I mean, I think, so we have a project with NOAA to, develop a framework to help improve the predictive capabilities of security risks posed by climate change, right? And I think, but I actually think that it's fairly in line with how you're talking about this, in that it's looking at the really knowing that climate change, the impacts of climate change are so specific to a specific context, right? Mm-hmm. And so looking at what are the existing physical environmental vulnerabilities? What is the state of political stability within a country? What are the regional transboundary dynamics? And then what are sort of the power and decision-making dynamics at each level, right? From the local, where you're going to, it's not, there's not going to be a homogenous sort of decision-making body, right? But so what are the dynamics on the ground all the way up into the international, and how do those scales of decision-making, is what we call it, sort of impact one another? And so in a way, in that way, I think climate change, thinking about how climate change interacts with those vulnerabilities, can be useful in taking the approach that you talked about with in regards to resilience and cooperation, and finding opportunities among those sort of four different dynamics, mm-hmm. To have sort of more effective responses and find entry points that wouldn't otherwise maybe have appeared, right? And so it's like sort of shifting our frame for how to build resilience, how to mitigate conflict or build peace, by understanding that climate change is going to shift dynamics all the way across, right? And so, like, it does seem that there's been a fair amount of, like, the academic debate has somewhat settled and an agreement that climate is not going to directly cause conflict necessarily, but it does interact with what the drivers of conflict are. And I know you talked about the importance of power dynamics. And so do you see, I guess in your research, have you found sort of more specific ways that climate will interact with some of those drivers, whether it's direct or indirect?
That's a really important question. I think that I have spent a lot of time looking into the real minutiae of power relationships at the local level. So I look a lot at, for example, gatekeepers, so kind of local elites who provide votes,
okay,
to a regime. And so how might climate change impact those types of really key power relationships? Because every regime is kind of it really is a combination of how much alignment they have subnationally. And so in this way, it's incredibly important to understand how shifts in markets, shifts in climate, shift in demographics, et cetera, are going to benefit some and have others lose. Because that in and of itself is a competition generator. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about is, of course, population compositions can be affected, especially, I think, by variable migration rates, especially internal migration rates. And that becomes important. I mean, to be honest, in a lot of countries I study, they just make the numbers up if they need to for votes. So the climate change isn't exactly the main interpretation there. But I will say, I'll come back to the notion of funding for these initiatives. The money that's going and how the money is distributed amongst subnational entities from national plans, whether it is a national adaptation plan like a NAPA, or whether it's a kind of a straight, more patronage-based exchange, the money is the some of the main fuel that is linked to competition. Now, whether or not the money itself, or let's call it climate finance, whether climate finance is linked to need is a big, somewhat unsolved question, but my interpretation is in fact it's more linked to ability to use that money towards future development than it is to need itself. And there's been a lot of really good studies, I think, on climate finance to suggest this. But it's this very conversation, and it's those details around climate finance, climate adaptation patterns that seem altogether missing from our understanding of what's happening in these communities. And this is what's happening. You know, they're not automatically reacting to the weather, which I think you're 100% correct that the research is suggesting this, but they're not even indirectly operating through it. It goes through so many different channels before it affects, you know, whether or not people are going to organize themselves into a violent group, which is it's quite a massive deal to do so. And so it's also not circumstantial, like how much of, or let's say intermittent, like how much of what we're seeing, the conflict episodic effects that we're seeing at the moment. And so there's a lot of ways in which I think we need to deepen our understanding, of course, development funding, adaptation potential, and resilience building.
That's great. I think the climate finance is something that we've been thinking about as part of our backdraft project, right? Looking at the unintended consequences of climate responses, right? And that, and the just the ramping up of climate finance and what that means for places, sort of, well, missed opportunities, right? Like who's in a position to access that finance? And if the potential for it to sort of fuel corruption or sort of entrenched power dynamics that are not ideal for people in different communities. Have you, so in your research, have you come across any cases where you've seen, and sorry, I'm going to put you on the spot here because this, but this is something we've been, a question that I get a fair amount, which is sort of examples of where programming on the ground has been sort of like a sort of a peace building project, for example, on the ground has integrated climate in a way that is effective and makes sense. Or maybe it's a climate response program that's not actually focused on climate per se, but is more about building that local resilience and sort of capturing the capacity on the ground that's already there and enhancing it. Just thinking about the places where you're focused, if you've seen any great examples to point to, or actually even ones that failed, right? And there are lessons in that as well.
So that is really interesting. Of course, like many of the times that people are trying to institute climate programs, they're doing it in areas of relative stability, right? And so I don't want to kind of lean into that streetlight effect of, which is the opposite of the one that I've been suggesting is active. But okay, so let me just give you an example of a case in which you certainly have kind of high levels of environmental risk. You have on top of that a high level of climate variability. On top of that, you have administrations, so like a political geography of this area that is contentious, and whether or not, or rather how it's dealt with, all these three types of issues. So if we think about what's called the Segan area of southern Ethiopia, you have many communities in which they're fighting for their own zone, right? And with the zone, you get, as we were just discussing, you get quite a lot of finance because you're allowed to appoint different administrators and things like that. And of course, you would then be able to access more finance when it comes to things like development aid, et cetera, as a result. And so the kind of political ecology of this system is one in which you are trying to first get some sense of dominance, if you will, or create such a sense of crisis that you're given a region in order to have some sort of a peaceful resolution of this first problem. And then that will create new opportunities to potentially build cooperation or to be now in competition for funds that were going to go to one area and now have to go to two areas. So do two areas get half of what they were supposed to get before? Or is there some ways in which they could build cooperation? And unfortunately, what's happening is that I think the same funds are being fragmented amongst contesting entities because of what we were speaking about before. Getting into that kind of pipeline of funds is the contest. And then from that, there's this, as you mentioned, backdraft.
Yeah, that's
a complicated example. Sorry about
that. No, but it's a good example, right? And then it's so how do you try to avoid that, which is a big question. So, real quick, ACLED is a go-to resource globally. What do you want to get? Are there any updates on?
Actually, one of the things that I will concede on some of my earlier points, which is that we've got this new early warning research hub, and we're going to be linking up with WorldPop, which is also a great resource.
Yeah.
And what we're going to be doing is looking at, for just one of the things we're going to be doing is being able to say something like, this insurgent group or this violent group is moving at this rate. And so given that, it will overtake or it will be engaged with populations under these types of stresses. And so what kind of outcomes do we predict or see or or can imagine maybe scenarios that involve. And that might be a really interesting way to try and interpret how people live under periods of multiplicative stresses, let's say, and then how they deal with another test case of fewer of those conflict stresses. And I think that's one of the areas that I find climate security to be some of the most illuminating is how the conflict itself has complicated people's adaptation rather than a causal direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Krina, it's been really wonderful to speak with you. I hope that we won't let another 12 years go by. We catch up again. Thank you for all the excellent research. You've just been a long time go-to resource for ECSP and for our whole network, and we really appreciate the work that you do. So thank you very much.
I'm so grateful for a chance to talk about the ideas. It's always quite nice to do so. Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.